Blog Talk Radio.
Host Merle Exit. It's 2 p.m. in New York City. I haven't stepped outside. I'm sure it's cold, but it's not snowing, thank goodness. And, well, I got a whirlwind of a show. I'm going all over the place again. We're going to first be going Irvine, California again, because we're going to talk with Britta, the owner of Britta's Cafe. And then the Kupferberg Center for the Performing Arts at Queens College in Flushing, New York. After that, we're going to be chatting about Traumas Auto School. Now, it's not trauma, but it sort of looks like it because it's T-R-A-M-A without the U. What a name for an auto school, huh? We're going to talk about being on a motorcycle, getting motorcycle lessons. And then, finally, Vikas Khanna. Well, he's an executive chef. And a few years back, Gordon Ramsay did something on one of the restaurants in Manhattan, and they brought in Vikas. And now the place is called Purnima, an Indian restaurant. And now Vikas has gone on to be the executive chef of another Indian restaurant called Junoon. So that's what's going to be now. Before, of course, we have. Let's see if I do. I got my new sponsor on here. Yes, good. I had to do some stuff here, but sponsor first. What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale. Yes, and you can get these absolutely delicious brownies by going to www.brownies.com. And this is going to be an interesting, I have to say, this is going to be quite an interesting show to do, if I can deal with that. My cat, yes. My cat insists. First, I thought my cat wanted to sit on my lap, but he has decided he wants to hang out on my shoulder. So I'm holding him, and he's next to the phone. So every once in a while, I don't know, you guys might be hearing purring from the cat. However, let's get to our first guest, Britta, I'm sorry. Are you there, Britta?
Hi, Meryl. How are you?
Okay. I thought, what's your last name? I forgot.
Well, Pulliam. Britta Pulliam.
Oh, okay. I guess that was there probably in December, I believe.
I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's telling me, and then I look at my computer and I go, oh, I mean, that was only like 3 months ago. It seemed like a year ago. Oh, it was last year. Yeah. Anyway, I want you to, what made you decide, I mean, you're not only came up with the menu, but you're also, like, I see you running around serving at the tables, too.
Absolutely.
And it's like, all around. Tell us how this restaurant came about, first of all.
Oh, gosh. Well, I started working for a very, very small little Italian restaurant when I was 15. And knew that the minute I walked in that door, I knew this is exactly what I was going to do the rest of my life, and started working towards that. And at the age of 25, I saved up enough money, and I opened my own restaurant, and I was on the Balboa Peninsula in California. And I was down there for about 14 years, and then I decided that I was feeling a little, like I needed to grow up a little bit and expand my culinary adventures, and I sold that location, and 6 weeks later moved up here, and I'm up by University of California in Irvine, UCI, surrounded by UCI, and have been here now almost 10 years.
Yeah, wow.
And I do
now,
everything.
but you worked in an Italian restaurant, yet, I mean, how did you come up with the, of course, you're also the executive chef, so.
Uh-huh. Yes.
How did you come up with the recipes or, and cuisine, rather?
Gosh, I guess it's just kind of evolved over the years, and it's kind of, I don't know, it's just... laying in bed at night thinking, taking a shower and thinking, coming to the restaurant, going to our local farmers market. We have a great local farmers market here, and just getting inspired and, you know, just kind of come up with the idea. I'm not sure sometimes.
So actually how would you describe the cuisine? What would you say then?
You know, I'm always kind of torn on to describe my cuisine, because I think I do have a lot of European influences in my cuisine. My family all came from Europe. I was born here, but everybody else is, you know, off the boat. I think most people have described my food as American food with European flares. I guess that's probably the best description. I guess basically American food, but, you know, there's a little duck confit there. There's a little spetzel, you know. So, yeah, I guess that's a good description.
Yeah. Comfort food for all.
Absolutely.
Do you get, and by the way, do you get mostly people from the university, or do you find it like, you know, a lot of people are popping over because you're so popular?
Yeah, popping because I'm popping. definitely the university is, you know, I get a good draw from the professors here at the university. They support me, and they're my loyal clientele. However, because I was on the peninsula in Newport Beach for so long, I still have my clientele that follows me up here. And, you know, I do pull from other people, you know, in the area. We're really close to Newport Beach, so we get a lot of the people from Newport Beach and Irvine and Costa Mesa that come here in California.
And when you've come up, let's say, with the recipes, I mean, let me go in the back and try this, see how this tastes. Is that what you kind of do?
That's what I do. And I go to the farmer's market. I have a little red wagon, and I walk around the farmer's market, and I try and get as many of my vegetables from local farmers. And, of course, we're really lucky here in California. You know, we can pretty much get a tomato almost year-round, and we can get, you know, we're spoiled rotten out here and as far as our vegetables go. And so, you know, I just kind of walk around and look for inspiration and get my fish and think, ooh, that would go great with that. That blood orange would go great with that couscous that I have in storage, you know, that kind of thing, and kind of create a meal from there. And that's kind of how I do it.
Are the blood oranges out there right now?
We're abundant of blood oranges right now. We have abundance of the blood oranges at the farmer's market right now.
I'm going to coagulate it for you so you can let me know where I can get the blood oranges from. Who's going to ship them to me?
Because
I can't. Certainly can't get them in New York.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So then what you do is you kind of like look at the, I guess after a while you get the sense of the spices or the herbs that
yes.
go with things. Is that what, you, what it
yeah,
is?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think after time you don't need to make everything and taste it. You're like, that works well with that. I've done that before, but maybe I didn't really like how, you know, like for example, we're having a great run on yellowtail right now on our local waters. So I've been doing a yellowtail on a bed, Israeli couscous with, we get some organic, what we call Bloomsdale spinach, and or Israeli couscous, and then I'm doing like a blood orange bacon vinaigrette on top. And at first I didn't do
okay,
the bacon.
A blood orange
bacon vinaigrette on top of the fish. And it's kind of a saucy thing, you know, on the bowl with the couscous floating around.
God.
But, you know, I did that last year, and I keep a journal and I write down what I do all the time. I'm very tactical. I have to write, and put pictures in. And I remember last year I did this when the blood orange was coming out, and I was never quite completely satisfied with it. So this year I thought, I'm going to make this even better, and I added bacon to it. So that was the new kind of thing that I think just kind of made it just right. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a crazy process, and a lot of it is, you know, I don't, you know, sometimes I think, wow, that was good. I don't know where that came from, but that was a good idea.
Yeah, by the way, the blood oranges, like, mm-hmm. are they just, is it the color or is it they extremely sweet?
I think that they have a little more of a honey taste to them, I guess would be a good way to put it. They have a little
okay.
more, I mean, they don't taste like honey, so that's kind of misleading, but they have kind of this more full, rounded body. I don't think they're sweeter, but they definitely have a different taste to them. Matter of fact, right now I'm getting ready to make some blood orange sorbet to throw in the freezer, too. Because they're just everywhere. You go to the farmer's market, there's blood oranges.
What do you do when you're making the sorbet? I mean, you're squeezing the juice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
I usually put a little zest of, I like my citrus sorbets with a little bit of the zest from the orange or the tangerine or whatever I do. Or I even
mm-hmm.
do Meyer lemon sorbet. And, yeah, you just basically make it sweet and freeze it up.
You're putting it in a blender, or what are you putting it
in? No, I make the juice. I squeeze it. I make a simple, kind of like a simple syrup would kind of be the best way to describe the sugar base. I melt the sugar so it's not, you know, it's not quite a simple syrup. It's not quite so thick and goopy. And melt the sugar,
right.
add the juice, let it cool, and then put it in your ice cream. It's really the easiest way. You know, to make.
Okay, so in other words, you have to, when you're making sorbet, you have to have, like, an ice cream maker.
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have said that, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, No, I just kind of wondered, because it happened that for the first time I tried a Meyer lemon.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the companies, I was in Texas, and the company had sent it to me. And I was, like, really surprised, because I can actually, like, eat a segment of
yeah.
the Meyer lemon the way I eat like a segment of an orange or grapefruit.
And you know, in California, we get a lot of Meyer lemons. They're kind of, those are abundant too right now. All of us seem
all right.
like, all,
so you got to give
like,
me.
I'll send you,
you
some of my
give
Meyer
me
lemons off my tree. How's that?
And you're definitely
you know,
going to have to give me somebody. That's,
yeah.
I got to get this stuff.
Now I can pick you some from my tree and send them to you. How's that?
Oh, that would be absolutely wonderful. I
yeah.
love that.
Absolutely.
Now, to get back, did you go to get a chance to look at my blog from when I was there?
I did. I read it late last night. And,
oh, good,
because yeah.
I forgot to look at it.
Oh, goodness.
I want to talk about what I ate.
So the main thing I remember is you had the Concord grape sorbet.
Yes, I knew it was something
uh-huh.
something having to do with wasn't
that was,
wine. It was something, yes,
yeah,
similar.
Yeah, we had Concord grape sorbet, and I think you were probably here, and maybe it wasn't December. I'm thinking maybe that was even more in the fall because that would have been when the Concord grapes were at their best. And we had I was trying to do a sorbet, and those Concord grapes, you know, they have a short life, and they're so great, and it's incredible. You don't have to add much sugar to make that sorbet because they're so sweet and so good. And we also do a Concord grape. When the Concord grapes are in, we do, like, a Concord grape. We take, like, like a it's not a wedge. We get petite little tiny icebergs, and we put them with blue cheese dressing, and we do gingered pecans, and we put those Concord grapes on top, and it is so incredibly good. If you can get past the fact that you have to have seeds in your grapes, which I don't mind.
Oh, right.
Some people
yeah.
have a problem with it because they feel like they have to spit them out. I just eat them, you know.
Wow. You know what? You got your menu in front of you? Oh, no, you don't need a menu in front of you. Please just describe what's on your menu. Just kind of go down the things and tell us what you have as opposed to what I had. Just scared.
Yeah, my menu changes all the time, of course, because I'm always, you know, every week I kind of tweak it a little bit. I think you were here for lunch, but I do breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so I'm, you know, here a lot. And at dinner time, we always have, you know, like fresh fish and chicken and pasta and steaks and, you know, a little bit of everything. Like I said, it always has like a little European flair. I always have duck confit. I love, love, love duck confit. And
now,
on my deathbed, that'll
my
be
audience,
you
know. Tell my audience exactly what duck confit is.
Duck confit, I mean, is usually we do it a duck leg, and it's usually a duck leg, and it's just cooked for many hours, and it's cooked in its own fat or duck render, and it's a traditional way of cooking it. And we always have duck confit on, and either we just change what we accomplish it. Like right now, we're doing it with turnips. Turnips are kind of popping up everywhere, so we do it with a turnip risotto. But I just love duck confit.
So in other words, basically, it's the duck leg.
It's a duck leg roasted for many, many hours. The duck meat just falls right off the bone when you get it. It's has a tendency to be a little on the salty side. So those who don't like salt, because of the way it's cooked, it's kind of like a ham. Like it does, you know, ham always has a salty taste to it. Duck confit always has a salty taste to it, but it's good.
I started making duck. You know the new wave ovens? You know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
I made a duck, a fresh duck in a new wave oven.
Yeah.
They come out perfectly.
Really?
Yes. It was amazing. I mean, it's like totally crispy skin and totally juicy on the inside.
Oh, just love ducks.
And it probably takes less time than I haven't used my oven yet. I think my stove is 4 years old. I haven't used the oven yet. But then again, see, because, well, one of the things I can't do is bake. I can't bake because baking is a science.
Yes, you have to be more exacting, yes?
Yeah. So let's go through, let's just pick out appetizers. Like today, what you got for appetizers?
Ooh, today, for like our little starter section, we have some clams, some steamers, and we have some assorted nuts. We do rosemary nuts. They're kind of spicy, salty rosemary nuts. What else do I have? Oh, I always have an artesian cheese plate on my menu, on my starter. I always have great, you know, we have some great cheeses here in California, and I get them from other places as well. And let's see.
I know what I had. Olives. You make your own olives.
I don't make my own. I get those olives from, they're called Meyer olives. They're in California. And they're California-grown olives. Yeah, they're incredible olives, those Meyer olives. Small farm.
Are you brining them or?
No, they come that way, and then we add like some gremolata and stuff like that to them just to.
Okay,
you know,
yeah, that's what I had. I remember
mm-hmm.
that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was really delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. What else?
Let's see: steamers, olives, cheese. What else do I have? Right now I have a roasted. And we have a wood burning oven, and I have a. Wood oven roasted pear that's in there, and we stuff it with goat cheese, and we serve it with a balsamic gastrique. So that's one of our more popular things right now, I would say. And I try and always do some kind of fruit roasted in the oven and stuff it with some kind of cheese. And the wood burning oven seems like it really complements that kind of roasted feeling in it. It's good. I like it. And we always do a small pizza, and we change that seasonally, too. And, of course, because we're in California, we have to have the artichoke, you know. And we always have artichokes.
Yes. Are the artichokes always in season? Or?
Almost always. We almost always can get an artichoke out here. Not always, but you can almost always get one. You know, we're... have the, what is it, Castroville is the artichoke capital of the world, so.
I don't suppose you have an artichoke tree, do you?
No. I wish. Too funny.
Yeah, I enjoy artichokes. I mean, I don't mind, like, you know, pulling them, you know, out, you know, like leaf by leaf and eating them as opposed to, you know, like cutting them in
yeah,
down
no, I like
to the. Yeah, but when I what I get, I got a Trader Joe's near me, and I'm able to get they're frozen, the artichoke hearts, and they're frozen, and
mm-hmm.
I enjoy that because I don't like them like out of a jar when they're you know in the brine or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
so you can get fresh frozen ones. Is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah,
I don't know if I see that at our trade. We're right next door to our Trader Joe's, and I don't know if I've ever seen it, but I guess probably being in California, you probably don't really need to have frozen artichokes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go now. I guess onto the entrees you have. What you got today?
Okay, well we do small plates and large plates, and let's see. Oh, we're doing a pork belly with a poached egg. I love pork belly. And then we do on our small – these are all on our small plates, and we do like – we always do a lamb, some kind of half of a lamb rack. And let's see. Oh, wild mushrooms. We've been getting some beautiful wild mushrooms from Oregon. So we've been doing some wild mushroom pasta. We've been getting also from Oregon some crab some Dungeness crabs. We've been doing Dungeness crab cakes.
Oh,
large! I know.
Yes, you know I can't get them here.
Yeah, you don't. You get blue crab, right? Yeah.
Well, we get blue crab, but they do have a. I know they're not Dungeness crabs. Like I go into the Asian market. And they look like Dungeness crabs, but they're not. They're close to it. They're that kind of like that size. But I think
mm-hmm.
they're an East Coast crab that kind of looks like that. Maybe from Canada or
maybe.
Something like that, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But there's nothing like that. I would rather have a Dungeness crab than lobster.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Mm-hmm.
I think, and it's also, I find it the least salty of crabs, and that has the most meat. That's what I find. If you're gonna make, if you're gonna do something to have crab meat with, you know, using crab meat, it's like got to be like the easiest thing to get the crab meat from, you know. And when people, it's also like with the body. I mean, there's so much meat in the body.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to trying to get that from any other crabs, you know.
Yeah, it's incredible. And this Dungeness. My father, when he was alive, lived in Oregon, and we would always go down to the. And he lived right on the water, you know, close to the water. So we would always go down to the bay and get those live Dungeness crabs. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
So it's not just California. I mean, it's the whole coast.
It's usually Dungeness. I'm sure you can get them in California, too. I always think Dungeness crab. I always think Oregon. But I'm sure
you can
get them up in Northern California as well. Yeah, we don't have them down here in the South, but definitely up north
yeah.
we get them.
It's mm-hmm. like the big thing when you go to San Francisco.
Yes. See, they would have them for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they do. They crack them and they sell them. You walk around and munch on them kind of thing.
Nothing
I remember
like
that
it.
From, yeah. Let's continue.
Okay, let's keep eating.
Yeah, let's keep eating.
Let's see. So then I do large plate entrees.
Wait, excuse me a second while I clean up the drool that just went on me. Okay, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So then I have a large plate section, too, you know, for a little more. And so we're doing a filet of beef that's stuffed with gorgonzola cheese. We do pork tenderloin right now with spetzel and red cabbage. And, let's see, we're doing a hanger steak, which I think it's more common on the East Coast than on the West Coast. A lot of people don't know what a hanger steak is on the West Coast here. And we do, we roast a wood burning.
What would you describe? How would you describe hanger steak?
Hanger steak is similar to a, I would say it's similar to a skirt steak in texture, but it's a little more round and thick. It's actually almost like a shape of a fillet. It's really good, and it has a lot of flavor. I tend to like more that type of cut of meat, even though it's a little more chewy than, like, say, a filet mignon. But, yeah, I love hanger steaks.
Oh, okay.
And right now I think we have some local sea bass that we have. And we're doing a vegetarian shepherd's pie this weekend. That's one of the things we're doing just with we always have a vegetarian dish on our menu. That is not a pasta.
How do you have a vegetarian shepherd pie?
I know. It's kind of a play on words. So it's vegetables that are baked with a potato crust. And I try to always have a vegetarian dish on there that is not a pasta. It seems like so many vegetarians, they always get saddled with having a pasta. So my vegetarian dish is never a pasta. It's always something like ratatouille with polenta we just did. We've done the vegetarian shepherd's pie. Trying to do something a little different other than pasta.
I want to get to some of the things, to get some ideas myself. So let's say, like, you have the sea bass. Give me some ideas, like, what would you use, herbs, spices, or whatever? What goes well?
Right now we're doing our sea bass. We're doing just a roasted garlic champagne vinaigrette on top of that. And it's like roasted garlic. It's like a roasted garlic vinaigrette would be the best way to describe it. And we're doing we're seeing some great Blue Lake green beans right now at our farmer's market. So we've been using those a lot. And we do mashed potatoes with it. So that's what we do with that.
When you're doing, now I'm curious, doing the sea bass, are you filleting the sea bass first or are you cooking it whole?
Oh, we're filleting it and we pre-portion it. We get our fish in and then we cut them up into like 8-ounce portions, 7-ounce.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I was curious because I'm shopping at my Asian market and I see sea bass. I'm going, okay, I'll go buy it. I don't know what to do with it, but.
Yeah, and we get great local sea bass here. So just off the off the coast of Baja, we get great local sea bass. It's beautiful, beautiful fish. And that's about all we're seeing fish local sea bass, yellowtail locally. We've been seeing a lot of that lately, and we've been getting in some opa, but those are more from the Hawaiian part of the water. You know. Mm-hmm.
Do you make your own desserts or do you have somebody else
doing it? No, we make all our own desserts here. And probably our most popular dessert is, well, I can't say that. I say that and then I think, well, maybe no, that's not true. But we do. We always have something chocolate. Right now we have a devil's food chocolate cake. We almost always have coconut cake. We're doing little Meyer lemon bundt cakes. Make our ice cream.
Oh, God.
Bread pudding.
Oh, wow.
Apple crisp. We almost always have some kind of crisp, apple crisp, blueberry crisp, something. And
let me quickly ask you, let's say when you're using the Meyer lemon, do you just squeeze the juice from it?
On our Meyer lemon bundt cakes, we actually zest the lemons, and then we do use the juice in the cakes. And it's kind of like a heavy pound cake that we do, but, it's still has some leaven in it, so it's a little bit lighter than a normal pound cake, but it's good.
In other words, as an idea,
it's my daughter's favorite.
Yeah. So, just like curious, in other words, let's say if I get a basic cake mix that's already, taken care of with the chemicals that are already in it, if I add the juice of the Meyer lemon and the zest in it, would that help?
Maybe.
You can't do that.
I don't know. I've never done a box cake mix. my daughter, my poor daughter, she's been like raised by me. So she we would go out to restaurants and they would say, and for you, little girl, you can have macaroni and cheese or grilled cheese sandwich. And then she'd go, thank you. And they'd walk away and she'd look at me. She'd go, do I have to eat that? So I'm like, no, you can have whatever. She goes, great, I'll have the pappardelle with the foie gras and wild mushrooms. And the waiter really looks at her like, can she eat that? I'm like, absolutely. But then when she was about 17, she came home and she said, Mom, did you know that they now make cakes in boxes and you don't have to add anything? You don't have to sift the flour? You don't have to do anything? And I'm like, yes, I do know that. And no, we're not getting them. So she's had a little sheltered life, you know.
Yeah. Oh, do you have a website?
Yes.
You push your website.
Oh, yeah, BritishCafe.com.
Oh, that makes it easy.
Very easy for me.
Without an apostrophe. Right?
No apostrophe, correct.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I the thing that's, by the way, the thing newsworthy, I don't know if you know that Irvine Tourism had just gotten their own, link.
Oh, wow.
I think it's Destination Irvine, I believe.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm.
So you can check it. I guess you're on there because I was speaking to Wendy. She said she had lunch there the other day. So it's one that she said it's one of her favorite places.
Oh, nice.
So,
yeah, no, I didn't know. I have to check that out. You know, I'm kind of in my little restaurant shelter all the time. So sometimes I always think, gosh, I wonder what's going on out in the rest of the world.
Well, I so appreciate your calling in. I'll clean up the drool afterwards.
Yes.
I'm going to just cook a chicken after I get off the air.
That sounds good. I love chicken. Sounds good.
Chicken with galanga root.
Galanga root's very nice.
Yeah. I just found that it actually, the taste of it, I didn't know one of my friends uses that. And then I said, have you ever, like, eaten it? I mean, like, because you'll eat ginger. I mean,
right.
You'll flavor things with ginger and you'll eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, no. I said, oh, well, I didn't know. I said, at first it tastes like mustard.
Yeah.
The flavor.
Well, like mustard.
And then and then it comes out kind of like lemony after.
Yeah. We have a lot, at our farmer's market, we have a lot of Asian farmers. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of those kind of interesting, different kind of things like that. You know, it's neat. Neat. I love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've blogged you, but I haven't gotten to the articles yet. So I'll get to that at
great. Thank you.
At some point.
And we'll talk, and I'll send you some Meyer lemons from my tree, and some blood oranges from the farmer's market. How's that sound?
Okay. I'll give you a call after the show.
Sounds good, Meryl.
So we
you have a great day.
It.
How's the weather? You stay warm in New York.
No. Yeah, I'll try.
I'll
take
you
care.
Some
have
California sunshine. All right.
Okay. Talk
Thank
to you later.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye. Yes. I don't know. I don't know about you, but aren't you like? Are you drooling? Did you listen to this? You just listened to the end, didn't you?
To me?
Yeah. You just listened to the end, didn't you?
I listened to the last part. Yes, it made me hungry. How could it not? I love food. Everybody cooks that food, eats food all the time.
And it's not just food. When people know how to do things with the food, it's like, I'm going to get off. When I get off the air, I have a chicken I'm going to cook, and I got to go. Well, you don't just take the chicken and not put any seasoning, just cook it and just eat it, you know? You got to do something to it. You got to add something to it, you know?
That's
so it's
right.
Those kind of decisions. Anyway, I'll introduce yourself to my audience.
Oh, okay. Hi, this is Patty Price, and I am the marketing director of the Kupferberg Center here at Queens College, located in the heart of Flushing. And it's a pleasure to speak with you today, Merle.
I wanted to talk with you because, first of all, I'm an alumni.
Oh, and so am I. I didn't mention that.
When I was there, there were spaces around the campus to walk.
What? Yeah, well, you know what? Most of those spaces are all filled up. Our latest space that's been filled up is now the Summit. We used to have tennis courts on the campus here, and they decided to make dormitories. We used to be just a no. We have actual. We have a beautiful new dormitory space here, right on the campus, and it's almost. I think it's almost completely filled. This is the first year, and it's doing wonderfully. So we're very proud of that.
I'm just curious. I mean, do you know if any of the other city universities even have that? Dorm?
You know, I don't know. We might be the first. I'll tell you the truth. I, you know, my end of the college is at the exact opposite end. I mean, physically,
yeah.
Where we're located, and also,
yeah.
Like, emotionally, and what I do here is the performing arts. So I don't get really involved in so much
wow.
the academic.
I'll have to get over to the campus and just... walk around. I'll get a golf cart to take me around.
77 acres. So you know, you do.
Yeah,
have to, yeah wow. We're big, but it's nice because right here in Flushing, where there's, you know, not that much green spaces left, we have an actual college campus and a big quad. It's open, and in the summer it's really lovely. So we try to do some outdoor events there, and the students really enjoy it. So it's nice. It's a very wonderful campus. I recommend it to anybody who is thinking about, you know, going to a city school or a state school. We have a great educational system here. So
When I was deciding on where I wanted to go...
Now, when was this? Was this back in the 60s, I think? No?
This was, yes.
Back in the
60s. Yeah, I had graduated high school mm-hmm. 1965.
Yep.
And then when I was looking to see where I wanted to go, what I actually did is I went... I didn't even go... I don't know if I even toured the campus. I walked there. I went over there. I looked at the campus, and I just said... I want to go here,
mm-hmm.
and because what I had was looking for was in the performing arts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, communications.
Oh, okay.
And so, but actually, I was a little disappointed. Somehow, I wanted to do musical theater.
Oh.
And I understood that understood that the Colden Center. Which
right.
was the former name mm-hmm. of the Kupferberg,
exactly.
was where, you know, things were done. And what had happened, I get to go there, and they decided that year they're not doing any musicals. And it's like, oh, what am I going to do here, you know, but... But the interesting thing was in noting the difference between the facility of what's now the Kupferberg Center
right.
and the facility of the theater at Queens College, the theater. And this was my feedback, where as the regular theater had much better in terms of traps or things, you know, that kind of stuff. You know,
well, exactly. There are different spaces here for different kinds of performances. In the Colden Auditorium
the Colden Auditorium. Yes, what I found with that was the acoustics were much better.
The acoustics are great there. I mean. We have had so many wonderful shows there, and I can tell anybody that you can sit in any part of that theater, and there's no dead spots. Even though it's a large theater, there's great sight lines, and it's got terrific acoustics. I mean, of course, if you really want to get the best acoustics of any of our, we have three major venues, is the LaFrac Concert Hall. Now, that's a smaller space, and it's where we put on our classical shows and our smaller jazz performances, but at 489 seats, it's actually considered acoustically perfect. And we use it, a lot of artists come and record here for albums because of the concert hall is all wood, and it was built in 1986 to a perfection that it rivals, you know, major concert halls, So we really are proud of that. But, you know, in the Colden Auditorium, when we have our bigger shows, people really enjoy the sound, and it's great. Now, the last theater we have is the Gold Stunt Theater. Maybe that's what you're talking about. That's like a black box theater. That's where we put on musicals and plays, and the drama department gets to do their thing there with the students. And we have great student productions at unbelievably cheap prices. So if anybody is interested in musical theater and doesn't want to schlep all the way into the city and spend $100 and God knows how many dollars,
right,
you know, support, you know, our students, and you'll see some unbelievable shows. They put on highly professional shows, and they're great. So I'm very proud of that, you know.
So, in other words, so the center now,
mm-hmm.
I have to call it the center.
Yeah, it's called Kupferberg Center.
Right, so now comprises Colden Auditorium, the Left, what'd you say, the Left Rack?
Mm-hmm, the Left Rack Concert Hall.
And one other, and
the
which
Goldstein
one?
Theater, right, the Goldstein Theater that I was just talking to you about.
So
we
the
have
Goldstein Theater, in other words, you guys took over the theater that was used by the drama department. Is
well,
that
we share
was?
It. We didn't take it over. We did a lot of sharing here.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
Exactly. So
that used to be the argument when I was there. You on this and we on that. You know, I was like, oh, God, you know.
You know, there's a limited amount of space, and
sure,
different people have different uses. And we really try to incorporate our theaters, our spaces get a tremendous amount of use, not only by us, but we also rent out our spaces. So on top of that, not only do we present, we rent. So, for instance, upcoming, it's not our show, but one of our next bigger shows is going to be Connie Francis, of all things. Now, you know, she's a legend, and we're not presenting her, but one of our promoters, who rents from us very frequently, puts on great shows, Gary Fuchs. He's putting on this show, and I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. So that's
so
coming up.
And is he using Colden Center?
He's using
Colden
Auditorium. Yes, he's using Colden Auditorium. And that's Connie Francis is coming. So it's kind of exciting, you know. I used to love her when I was a kid. I listened to all her music. So, you know, he did a lot of the oldie shows that you might have heard from. But, you know, other than that, then we've got, you know, our spring season is just getting into full gear now. So we've got lots going on, and I'm trying to keep up with everything at the same time. It's kind of like juggling everything at once, and juggling.
I'm going to be seeing Linda Eder next month. Huh?
Oh, my God. I love her. She's been here twice, I think. She's been here by herself, and then she was here with Michael Feinstein, and she's coming back, and she's coming back on March 12th, Saturday night, and she's doing a new show. I don't know whoever is a fan of Linda Eder, maybe they started out because, you know, she was in Jekyll and Hyde, and
right,
she's got that marvelous voice. I think it's been compared to, like, Barbara Streisand. She's got an incredible range, and she sings unbelievably. Well, anyway, this new show highlights her. She'll sing her Broadway stuff, but she'll also incorporate, she's gone into a new area. She's doing country music now, and I hear she's fantastic. And she's doing original songs, and she's doing covers to popular songs, and she's going to, and it's called All of Me. So that gives you an idea as to the kind of span of things that she's going to be performing that night. We're excited about it. I think she always puts on a fantastic show. So I'm really looking forward to hearing her and hearing this new style that she's coming out with. So you're coming to see that, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I just got her, I recently got her new CD called Now.
Oh, yes. That's the one where she's reunited with Wildhorn.
Yes.
Yes, and you know they were married and divorced.
That's when I first thought that when I had gotten this press release regarding the CD that she was going to be performing with him at the concerts on tour.
That would have been fun, but no, she's not touring with him. She just, from what I understand, she's made this career, this album with him, and it's going to be music that he's written and composed, which he made her famous with his Jekyll and Hyde. So it's probably really fantastic music. But she will be singing, I'm sure, some music from that and, you know, other things too. You know, she's got her favorites that everybody wants to hear her sing. But she's very versatile. And she said that, you know, her heart, you know, is close to country. So I'm curious to see. I think in the summertime, my sister had told me she had seen her in a concert here on Long Island. You know, the concerts in the park. And I saw Linda Etter do one of those free concerts in the park, and she did country music, and she was fantastic. And I said, really? I said, wow, I never knew, you know, she was a country. But there you go. There's all the facets of Linda Etter, and we get to see them when she comes here in March. So I'm looking forward to that. Yes, that's going to be a great show. And then in April, we've got another great show. This I'm really totally, totally psyched about. It's called The Midtown Men. And it's from the four stars from the original cast of the Jersey Boys. And they're...
Really?
Yes, the four original cast members. The actual... the guy who won the Tony, Christian Hoff. He won the Tony as Tommy DeVito in Jersey Boys. And then there's Michael Longoria, and he played Frankie Valli. Then there's Daniel Wright. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's Reichardt. And then the last guy, J. Robert Spencer, he was nominated for the Tony. And they were the original four cast members who originated the Broadway show. So they're putting together this...
This is when?
This is in April, on April 9th, Saturday night, here in Colden Auditorium. It's going to be a great show. They're going to be singing everything, Beatles, Beach Boys, Four Seasons, Motown. And it's a very... exciting show. It's gotten fantastic reviews. People absolutely love them, and they're real pros. They do it all. They sing, they dance. It's fantastic. So
put me down for press tickets for that one too.
Definitely. You'll enjoy that one. I mean, coming from our generation, because I'm in the same generation as you. You know, they hit home. That's where I live. You know.
Yep. Well, let me ask you, when you were attending there, did you ever do anything with the performing arts at all?
You know, it's so funny. Well, when I was a student here, and I came back as a returning student, so I only graduated Queens College in 1995, so I didn't even know this place existed. It's so sad. You know, I had to go to one performance to fulfill a music class, and it was the Messiah, which they do for Christmas time here.
Yeah.
And I didn't know where I was going. I was looking for, where is this auditorium? I was walking, it's all the way around the other side of where all my science classes were, on the other side of the campus, so I hardly even passed by it. And that was the first time I even knew that there was a performing arts center here on the college campus. So, of course, now, you know, I know everything that's going on, because not only do I, you know, work on these events, we kind of hook together with the rest of the arts on the campus. We have museums here, and, you know, there's a lot going on, not only just performing arts. So, you know, Queens College is really a good center for the arts, and, you know, I'm kind of proud of that, too. I mean, being an alumni, I just, you know, I feel a sense of pride, I guess, that the college is... Yeah, that is, we've come so far, you know, and times are tough, but everybody's really sticking together and doing their best. And, you know, the economy is very difficult now for performing arts of all kinds, and especially in our nonprofit, because we're a nonprofit, you know. So So we have to make do with these small budgets and trying to let people know. I mean, fortunately, we have that big, huge marquee. Have you seen the big, huge marquee that faces the LIE? It's got, you know, it's a huge marquee, and it shows, you know, our events, and it splashes them on. So hopefully people will look at that. And, yeah, it's, you know, there's a million cars passing by every day, and they can see what's going on. You know,
how is parking for the shows?
Oh, we've got parking here. We've got free parking, and it's secure, so that's good. The key is to get here a little early so that you get here before the parking lots. They can fill up. And in that case, the college does everything they can to accommodate extra cars. Sometimes they open the gates and people can park inside. And there's parking on the street, too. But usually you can get parking in the lots. And as I said, it's free. And it's secure because there is a security guard and they're all gated around. And it's very convenient. It's right down the steps from the Colden Auditorium across the street. And we have handicap parking and all kinds of facilities for people with, you know, different kinds of abilities or disabilities, as it were. So we try to conform to everything and make it easy for people to get here and while they're here to enjoy the show and have a pleasant, you know, experience. And to that end, we're actually working right now on renovating the facade and redoing the bathrooms in Colden Auditorium and Goldstein. It's going to be beautiful when it's done. Business as usual. Everybody can still come to see the shows, but they will be working on the exterior and lighting and beautifying the area. It's going to be really, really nice when it's done. So that's another exciting thing that's going on here.
I'm getting flashbacks. I had actually performed a few times on the stage of Colden Auditorium.
It's a big stage. Do you remember how it felt looking out
on
all those seats?
It was, I have to tell you, it was the first time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had been in, like, in show business since I was 14. I'm a comedian and singer.
I know you are. And you are an author.
And an author.
And a cat lover.
And the director of public relations for the New York Sharks women's football team.
Oh, my God. So where do you find the time to do everything? I don't know.
I don't know.
You must have
a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I have a tremendous amount of energy. Just, you know, doesn't go. Yeah. But the interesting thing, it was the largest audience that I've ever performed to, being in the Colden Center. Actually, it didn't even bother me. I don't know if they even have. They used to have this thing called. They had house plans. I don't know if they still have them.
Yes, they used to have house plans, and they used to put on
shows. Follies, Frolics.
My sister was in one of the house plans. I think she called it. She said it was Theta Nu, or something like that. It was a small house plan, and I actually was younger, and I came to watch her perform, and they were fantastic shows that they put on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when I was with a house plan, what they would do is a male house plan and a female house plan would team up to do a show. That's the way they had done it. And I don't even remember the name of the house plan we teamed up with, but the guys that were in that house plan wound up going off to California and writing for Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley.
I know. When you see the number of people who have come out of Queens College and who've gone on to be, you know, famous. And
yeah, except I want to find out why What's-His-Face never wrote a Queens College song. He wrote enough, you know what I mean? I mean, he never composed enough things. So how come there was no Queens College song?
I don't know. Good question. I haven't a clue. I haven't a clue. But the house plants have are not in existence anymore.
Oh, okay.
To answer your question. They have a lot of clubs here on the campus.
Yeah.
You know, all different kinds of clubs, but they don't have any formal any house plants or sororities or fraternities at this point.
Yeah, that's just kind of when there's no room.
Yeah, you know,
it was so spacious when I went, you know, and it and then little by little I was going, oh my God, another building, just even as I'm leaving or
exactly, you know, space is at a premium here, so
did you know about the underground tunnel?
The underground tunnel. Yes, I know. I've heard of them. I've never been in them. But from what I understand, there's a whole underground that you can get from building to building, something like that. But, of course, I had never seen them, and I don't know where they are or how you even access them. I don't think
we get to do that.
I think they're going to give that information out to the public.
No, I think I had heard something that there was a former prison there or something. That's what I had gotten. And the underground area was alongside, let me see, what's Melbourne Avenue.
Well, before the college was built, this was a juvenile, like a detention. There was some of the older buildings, I think they were, they housed like young adolescent juveniles for different reasons. And what happened was that there was almost like a shocking expose on their treatment. And Charles S. I think Fiorella LaGuardia was instrumental in turning this into a campus, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, okay.
And I think we started in the 1942 or 1941 was the first class of Queens College, and we call them the pioneers now. You know, that's the name of our alumni, our senior alumni. They're the pioneers, and you'll be surprised when they come to these events. They're wonderful people, and some of them have gone on to do fantastic things. As a matter of fact, one of the pioneers is Max Kupferberg, one and the same gentleman who gave us the money that is helping to support the arts and helping to renovate and do our capital campaign here on the college campus, and that's why we, of course, changed our name to the Kupferberg Center. So, but he's a wonderful person. Max and Selma Kupferberg donated the largest amount of personal donation that anybody has ever given to the campus, and fortunately, it was for the arts. And so we benefited, and all of these wonderful things are happening now, as I said, with the renovations and helping with our programming and such. But they came back, and they give. So, you know, you never know. You absolutely never know. So, yeah, so the college was built back then, and then eventually in 1961, that's when they built Colden Auditorium. So,
How often does Marvin Hamlisch come to do anything?
You know, since I've been here, I haven't seen Marvin Hamlisch. I do believe that he has done some special events in the past. He has been here, but not in a long time. I don't know. They've gotten him to do some sort of fundraiser that they've put together, but it was not here, actually, on the college campus. But,
I think
did you go to school with him?
Opened up Left Rack?
Huh?
The Left Rack Center. He was there for that? I think
because
that's something I seem to remember.
You might be right. You might be right, because when they have these, you know, momentous occasions, they try to get people who have the connection and people who, you know, have this talent in the arts. And certainly, you know, he's a big, huge name.
Who else is coming up, by the way? Just want to make sure that people know.
One thing I'm excited about, and this is very cool, and it's very cool. It's called Cool Beats. It's our jazz festival. We've got a two-day, I should say two-night Jazz Festival on Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd, and it's going to highlight some of the great new, young, talented jazz artists in the Queens scene, and these are also well-known within the jazz world. We have Jeb Patton, Michelle Marie, Kong Vu, Antonio Sanchez, and Danilo Perez Trio over two nights, and they'll be doing all their different kinds of jazz. Ticket prices are really low. We have special student prices that are like $15 for students with ID. So we're trying to encourage young people to, you know, get involved and get a little bit of an understanding of what jazz is all about. So that's going to be in the Lefrak, and it's a tribute to Sir Roland Hanna. Are you familiar with Sir Roland Hanna? He was an instructor here in the music department at Queens College at the Aaron Copland School of Music, and he's also a jazz legend, composer, arranger, and a musician himself, a pianist. So we're doing a tribute to him. Jeb Patton is going to be performing his works on Friday night, and it's going to be a really, really great show, and there's still great seats left, and people should not miss that one. And on top of that, we're giving people who are interested in coming to an afternoon workshop with these artists, it's free. So if they purchase a ticket to, say, the Friday night show, they'll be able to, prior to that, actually sit down with these artists and do a hands-on workshop. And that doesn't happen every day. So they're trying to reach out, and I think that that's a great thing. You know, part of our mission here is, you know, to teach and educate about arts and arts education, and we do it in a number of ways. And these, Michelle Marie, she came to us with this idea, and we decided, yeah, it was a great idea, and we are co-presenting it with her and her production company, so we're looking forward to that. And it's very accessible jazz, you know. Some people are worried that they're not going to like it because it doesn't have a melody or they can't connect to it, but I think if you were to come to these performances, you would see a very accessible kind of melodic and harmonious jazz and rhythmic. And some of it has like a little bit of a Spanish twist to it, or I should say a Latin twist to it. So you'll get a nice range of different styles coming from these young musicians that are really, really great. And so that's
Patty, what's the website that people can go to?
Okay, well, they can go to kupferbergcenter.org. That's a mouthful, but it's right here at Queens College, and it's KUPFERBERG, kupferbergcenter.org. And everything is, and they can buy tickets online, or they can get more information about all the great things we're doing. And we got family shows coming up, and we've got a comedy pet theater, Gregory Popovich, could you believe it? Straight from Las Vegas, cats and dogs on the stage, trained.
And when is that?
That's going to be Sunday, the 27th of March. And he's been on The Tonight Show, David Letterman, America's Got Talent. I've seen the video. It's absolutely hysterical. He's trained these animals. They were originally from shelters. And he's taken all these shelter animals, and he's made them like Las Vegas stars. That's all I can say. You have to see it to believe it. But he's amazing. So, yeah, we've got more stuff, too. But these are some of the things that we're doing, and I hope everybody comes and takes advantage of it, because our prices are among the lowest that you'll see in all of the city. So,
well, I'm going to talk to somebody and find out if they can give me a tour of the campus.
Oh, sure. I can give you a tour of the campus.
I can't do all that walking. I mean,
you need one of those little electric carts that they have around here. We have all these little electric cars now.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. Anyway, I'll have to continue on with my next guest. So I appreciate you calling in. I'm going to call you after the show to talk about a couple of things that I'd like to cover Of course, since I write for the Queen's Times, I can, you know, get all the stuff in there.
Great. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going back there.
You're always welcome
going,
back. We welcome our
moving,
alumni, you know.
Oh my God.
I know, you'll go into the different buildings and say, oh my God, I remember
yeah.
this, I remember that. Yeah, it's
okay.
cool. All right.
Great, well, I'll talk to you later then.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks again for calling in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, bye.
Have a good one, bye.
Too. Yeah, and that's one of the things that people should take advantage of is the colleges in their areas anyway that utilize talent or bring in talent for shows, and a lot cheaper than if you're going to the theater and, you know, larger theater, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. one way, I guess, that you can get there is by going on a motorcycle if you so choose. And of course, you would have to take motorcycle lessons. And how did you like that segue? What'd you think? You're on the air, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How'd you like that? It's the way I got into talking about motorcycles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Basically, I'm a representative from Traumas Auto School, and we not only do auto instruction, but we do motorcycling as well. We offer the Defensive Drivers course, as well as the five-hour pre-licensing course that you're required to take before you can actually apply for either a New York State license and/or motorcycle endorsement. As far as motorcycling is concerned, I'm one of the rider coaches that is certified by the Motorcycle Safety Foundation, and it's a preset curriculum that's based on a study that was based back in 1968. Was it called the Hertz Study, in which they found things that people got into motorcycle accidents. They want to analyze what caused them, and then figure out what course of instruction could be made available to the general public that would either reduce or eliminate some of the accidents that would occur to beginning motorcyclists. We have, as far as trauma is concerned, we're actually located, our headquarters is located in Woodhaven, Jamaica. But we teach classes in several different areas. We teach out of Queensbury Community College, if you're out in the city. We also have the Nassau Coliseum, which is located out in Uniondale. It's where the Islanders play. And then we're located in Hop Hog, which is relatively new to us. We've been over there only 2 years now, but it's a nice course. And we used to teach at Brookhaven Laboratories, and we're looking to do that again this year, pending approval. And basically, the motorcycling course itself is pretty simple. We have you fill in an application, and if you've never ridden before, we have a simulator here at Woodhaven that you can practice on. It actually has real controls and a motor operates, so you can get used to the actual feel of a motorcycle if you're interested. It's the thing that gets you used to riding. There's no balance involved, per se, but it gets you used to the controls, and that's perhaps one of the more important things to be able to use when you're out riding is the controls and the
belts. Wait, there's no balance? Like, you're not dealing with, like, the balance, like, of a bike?
No, it's actually put on a stand. It's on a fixed stand. So you actually
You mean just the simulator, meaning?
There you go. Yeah, I guess that's a better word.
In other words, when you're on a bike itself, you're dealing with balance, right?
Right. You're actually.
Oh, okay.
You'll be sitting on a simulator. It's held fast.
Mm-hmm.
It won't tip over or anything like that. But you have all the controls available to you to practice with if you've never ridden one before. And it's kind of daunting if you've never ridden a motorcycle and or a mechanical device like this either. So it's a good introduction. We go with 1 hour sessions, and you just call the office and set up a time for that. And if you're still interested, then we have an actual course that we have that you could get that you could sign up for. If you after the simulation you're still not unsure of whether you do or don't want to ride a motorcycle, we have private lessons available to you. They are $75 per hour. We have our certified instructors. All you have to do is show up. We'll provide a motorcycle. You just need to show up with a long sleeve shirt or an inner jacket, a set of gloves that cover your fingers and reach up to your wrists, a sturdy pair of shoes that cover your ankles, and we'll do the rest. We've got helmets for you, and we'll spend about an hour with you introducing you to the controls and actually have you, if you're quite good at riding, we'll have you riding around the parking lot, closed lot, within an hour. And if you want to ride some more, you can, you know, take on some more lessons. It just builds up your confidence before you take the course. And after we get to that point and you're still happy and you're confident that you want to continue with this, we have what we call is the Basic Rider Course. It introduces you to basic manipulative skills, and we introduce you to risk awareness, things that you might want to be aware of when you head out on the highway and or road. There are a lot of things you need to pay attention to because, number one, you're obviously on two wheels and you require a little bit of balance. So it's a little different between a motorcycle and an automobile, and you're probably a little bit more vulnerable. So we'll talk to you about risk, how to handle it, what to look for, and how to avoid situations that could get you in trouble. The actual course itself consists of 5 hours classroom in which we go over protective equipment, the motorcycles themselves, different types of risks, and then we'll talk about what techniques you might need to successfully ride a motorcycle. And then we'll spend approximately 10 hours out on a closed range. It's a New York State-approved closed range, and there would be no outside interference, so there's no cars passing by, so you're pretty well protected. One of the key things our rider coaches focus on is safety. Rider safety is paramount, and with the curricula that they offer you, its safety is built in. So there's very few chances that you would seriously injure yourself if you just kind of pay attention and you have an aptitude to try and ride. After that, if you do graduate, you'll be issued a completion card. The completion card is what you would take to the Department of Motor Vehicles and have them, you'd have to fill out some paperwork to have the M endorsement added to your basic driver's license. And the key thing there is when you do actually finish this and get the completion card, the requirement to take an actual New York State motorcycle test is automatically waived. So if you complete the written portion that we offer you, and you complete the writing portion of it to you, which is really not that difficult if you kind of pay attention and have some basic writing skills, you'll be a successful rider at the end of about 2.5 days. And that basically is the basic course is what we offer. It doesn't make you a perfect rider. It introduces you to things you might see out on the street and encounter. And then from that point on, you'd have to practice on your own. And kind of like after you've earned your driver's license, you'll pick up more experience as you ride a little bit more.
Now, do you also teach how to ride on a highway?
No, we don't. That's something you would learn if you were to perhaps join a club or learn to ride with another rider. A lot of people we get are interested in riding because either relative, friend, or someone else at work might have interested them, and what we do is we try to kind of segue them into the system and give them the approved methods, which would make them a safe rider. And from that point on, the judgment is based on the individual themselves. How much risk would they want to take? I would not recommend any of my students head out on the highway immediately after graduating. I would basically tell them to take a little time to practice, build up confidence. I think the key thing is once they build up that level of confidence that they feel better at it, then they might take a ride with one of their friends and try the highway, wherever that might be, a secluded highway, not something like the Long Island Expressway or something like that, but something rural that they could feel comfortable in. And we would like to see them build up a little bit more confidence. That's the whole thing about riding, having that confidence.
Well, let me ask you a question. I know, like, as a driver, I notice, like, motorcycles will weave in and out of the traffic. you know, like they'll pass in between cars. Is that allowed or?
Well, it's passing a vehicle is allowed. That's not the issue. I think the issue you're addressing here is it's a dangerous pass or whatever they're doing is not within the constraints of safety in mind, and that does happen. I can't speak for the rider, but we basically teach our riders to maintain a safe distance between vehicles, use good judgment when passing. If there is, and this happens a lot, if there is a traffic jam, it is not permitted in the state of New York to go between automobiles. That's called lane splitting, and it's not approved in the state of New York.
So they're just doing it anyway and hoping there's no cops.
Right, that's exactly what it is, and you would hope that someone doesn't stick an arm out the window at the wrong time.
Yeah, right. Oh, okay. I was just curious about that because I see that happen, you know, a lot, and not just New York, but you know, other places.
Yeah.
Now, do you let me just ask you a question? I'm not sure if you know this. Let's say if somebody like doesn't renew their license. Their driver's license as far as like a regular car.
Okay.
How long can they go without having to, let's say, take another test?
You talk about the motorcycle portion of it?
No, just a car.
For the car, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that one. If they've never renewed it, I would imagine they'd have to start all over.
Oh, no. I guess what I'm asking is like how much of a period of time has to pass before you, like, okay, you go into the Motor Vehicle Bureau and say, hey, I'm renewing my driver's license. Let's get it over with.
Okay.
In other words,
normally,
like, yeah.
Normally it's printed on your license, an expiration date, and it's normally on your birthday. The purpose of
I guess what I'm asking is, let's say, okay, so it now passed, it's not, and your birthday, it's time to renew your license, and it's like, you know, you're putting it off on getting it renewed. And in other words, okay, all right, I better get it done within the next year or 2 years, because if I don't, then I would have to, let's say, maybe they'll want you to take another written test or blah, 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 blah. Would you know that information? Like,
no, I wouldn't know that one. You'd probably have to call the office and ask that one. I'd probably have to look at a New York State driver's manual to give you an answer on that one. Normally my focus is on... my forte is more along the line of rider coach and instructor, motorcycling, yes.
And so, in other words, when you're giving, so you've never like given the 3 hour classes or 5 hour things like that, right?
No. There's the 5 hour pre licensing class that everyone's required to take, and we offer that at the main office.
And that's for the motorcycle.
Well, yeah, in order to get a motorcycle license, you
right.
would need a New York State driver's license.
So, and the thing that they have at the schools, the three-hour one is to get points or whatever off your license or
yes.
for your insurance.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So they facilitate that, too. Now, I mean, I'm familiar with the place in Woodhaven.
Mm-hmm.
At the other places that you mentioned,
yes,
are they just for the motorcycles, or is it the same kind of setup that each one of these places that you can there's a classroom, et cetera, is an indoor facility for stuff?
Classroom. When we break down classroom. We normally conduct, for the motorcycle classes, we conduct classroom instruction in Massapequa, and that's normally held in the evenings
mm-hmm.
before we head out on the range.
So,
the range
in other words, I guess what I'm asking, so there's a trauma in Massapequa?
Yes,
or you're using a facility? Oh, okay. So you go into Massapequa and you see it says trauma, you know, water school.
Yes, it's a facility we use to instruct the motorcycle students. It's part of their instruction that they give. It's a 5-unit block that they have to receive, but that's where we normally do it.
And how about, let's say, you said at Nassau Coliseum, what Is it like, meet me at Nassau Coliseum at the blah, 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 and that's where we're going to do this?
Yes.
Or
no, you're right.
Something there.
No, you're right. You're on the right path. We normally have, again, for the Nassau College students, we have them also meet at Massapequa the first night. Then we'll issue them out little maps to show them where we're going to meet. And it's normally in the western corner of the Coliseum parking lot.
Okay. And so, in other words, what you're saying is, and it's, I guess that's the kind of the same thing what you said, like Brookhaven?
Yes. Brookhaven, okay. Basically the same, yes.
Yeah. So, in other words, there are actually how many, and I'll have to call them storefronts.
That's a good question. Yeah, that's the storefront. The main one is in Woodhaven, and then
we have
a satellite. Yeah, the satellite is in Massapequa.
Okay. So in other words, there are two.
Yes.
Two storefront locations. Okay. Now,
right.
I just wanted to kind of get it clear. So in other words, it's two storefront locations, but the other locations you mentioned are like where you get to meet for something.
That's correct. Now,
for
the Queensborough crew, we normally meet in the administrative building for our first class that night.
Okay.
So we use their classroom facilities because it's nicely set up. So they have everything we need. It's comfortable. We have desks, chairs, and things set up already for the students.
Do you find that people out of New York State come there too? I mean,
Rarely have we had one. Now, it's funny that you ask that because on occasion we have other courses available. We have what we call a Basic Writer Course 2, which is an experienced writer course, and that generally is not as in-depth as the basic course. It's only a five-hour course on a weekend, and yes, I have had students from out of state actually show up and attend for a refresher class. It's nothing more than a refresher of the basic writer course. We go, again, through the manipulative skills that they've already earned, but now we focus more on control and advanced techniques of writing. At this point, they now have the confidence to be able to write, and what we're looking for now are the habits that they've picked up, and we're going to point out the ones that they're doing well and reinforce those. And sometimes we pick up some bad habits and don't know that, and that's what our writer coaches look for, those little habits that might get you in trouble. And then we'll just point them out to you as you're doing some of the writing exercises.
Okay. By the way, does trauma also, like, teach the people who are going to teach?
Do you mean as far as motorcycle endorsement type of classes?
Just in general. In other words, suppose I want to work at an auto school in upstate New York or something.
Okay.
Does trauma also teach?
Oh, yeah.
How to teach?
Yeah, you're right. Actually, that's a good question. Yes, most of the rider coaches we do have are certified by the state of New York. There are, our higher bosses that we respond to is New York State Motorcycle Program. They have a program manager who's located in Albany. We respond to him. For candidates who we feel would be suitable to become instructors, rider coaches, we coordinate with the New York State Motorcycle Program and establish a classroom time, a date, in a location where they can actually bring their certified instructors down and teach us how to be certified instructors. So there is a method for becoming certified in the state of New York. It's all run under the auspices of the Department of Motor Vehicle. Everybody has to be certified. And actually, when we do become certified, we're actually issued an instructor certification card, which we must carry at all times in order to instruct, whether it be automobile and or motorcycle.
Well, in other words, I guess, let's say the five-hour class, let's say, for instance.
Okay.
Okay. Now, suppose, let's say, you know, an auto school in upstate New York, okay, mm-hmm. and they have somebody that they to use to teach. They just want to teach the 5-hour class.
Okay. They would have
Could
to be
they
certified.
Could they come to trauma and learn how to teach that 5-hour class?
No, I can't answer that one. I guess my owner, our owner, B, Trauma, would be the one we have to answer that
okay.
one. I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, okay. I wanted, because I kind of wanted to kind of get it out there. I know, like, the terms of, like, the 3-hour kind of thing
okay.
is all over the place. It's so in other words, I can either, like, come to you because I need the 3-hour thing, or come to you because I want to teach the 3-hour thing at another auto school.
True. That is correct.
Okay.
That could be so.
Yeah. How long have you been doing this?
I actually was certified back in 2004, so this will actually be my 7th year or 8th year of teaching students. And it's a rewarding experience to watch people actually arrive who have never ever ridden before, and then we have students who have, and just watch them progress from the very first day where they're just looking at the handlebars and trying to figure everything else out. And at the end of the second day, third day, they're actually riding with speed and pretty good confidence. It's a tremendous transformation. And to ride a coach, that's perhaps the greatest satisfaction, is seeing students leave happy, achieving what they set up. There's a motivation for coming here, and we try and help them meet their goal. And that's one of our focuses, as well as making them a safe rider.
And how long have you been riding a motorcycle?
Myself, I guess close to 30 years now. I started out on dirt bikes, then moved all the way on up. So it's a matter of, I guess it's kind of, you want to crawl, then you want to learn to walk, and then you can run. So I've had a lot of time riding two-wheel vehicles.
Wow. I mean, the motorcycle itself, how long has it been? For 30 years or just
yes,
or 30 close, years meaning?
I've total time, I've been spending over 30 years riding motorcycles. I just
wow.
actually rode my motorcycle about a week and a half ago. So, it's a hobby that you can get very interested in. Some people are focus more on different aspects of motorcycling than others. You have the racing genre. You have the ones who are the touring genre. Then you have the cruising genre. There's a whole host of things you can do with a motorcycle. There are a lot of people you can meet out there. They have different groups, different organizations that are great. Camaraderie is a key thing in motorcycling. And it's just a lot of fun. And at this point now, with gas going up to $5 in the future, it might be something.
I was going to comment on how, in terms of, would you say, if you wanted sort of a percentage of how many people say, I want to learn how to ride a motorcycle as a way of getting around, as opposed to, you know.
As another means of transportation? I would say about 15 to 20% use it seriously enough to say, you know, I would be willing to park the vehicle away and use this as a primary commuter.
Okay.
Now, here's something else that's interesting, and I didn't mention this to you.
Sure.
We also teach people how to ride scooters if they're interested. If you're daunted by the fact that your motorcycle sounds too big, too powerful, we can start you out on a scooter and get you used to riding a scooter. And if you feel good about that, then you can step up and take motorcycle a little bit more seriously later on. Now, in the state of New York, this is sometimes not understood. Any two-wheel vehicle that goes over 30 miles per hour requires a motorcycle endorsement.
Right.
There are a lot of scooter riders out there who are riding scooters who are not properly endorsed, and they just don't know that. But anything that goes over 30 miles an hour, you're required to have a motorcycle endorsement at this point in order to operate legally within the state of New York. That's just a little tip for those scooter riders out there. I know there's a lot of them out there, and you know, there's some pretty good scooter riders out there. I just don't know that not all of them know that that's required by the state of New York.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna at some point talk to B and see if I can do an article on Merle attempts to learn.
That would be great.
How to ride. And I say attempt because, and I'm going to tell you my problem is that when I learned how to ride a bike,
mm-hmm.
you use your feet to brake.
That's true.
And I still want to use my feet to brake.
Well, you use.
So when they started with the handle, with the hands, I'm going, I don't like this. I want to brake with my feet. You know.
Well, you actually. One of the brakes on the motorcycle does use your foot. That's the right rear brake pedal. So you'll still be able to use your feet. You'll use hands and feet.
Yeah, we'll have to do this. The other thing that the other reason I wanted to write about this is for people who enjoy snowmobiling.
Okay.
Because if you can get some sense of how, even if you took an introductory course on riding a motorcycle, it's kind of that kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, because it's the handbrake.
Right.
But also, the problem I was facing was turning the vehicle.
Oh, that's simple.
And I'm thinking that I'm turning it, you know, because I'm driving a car, and you don't have to lean.
Yeah.
You're driving a car.
That's
true.
You
know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I had a problem, but having not ridden a bike for a long time, a regular bicycle for a long time, I forgot that when you're on a bike, you don't even think about it. When you're riding a bike, you don't think about whether you're leaning or not. You automatically lean when you're turning.
Yes, you do.
And it's just something that you normally do, and you don't think, oh my God, if I lean, I'm going to fall. Oh,
that's true.
It becomes part of it, and you know you have control when you're leaning. You know, you sort of know how far to lean. what I mean?
It's subconscious.
Yeah. So the thing is that's one of the things that I want to kind of get into a bit for people who enjoy, who would like to do snowmobiling and feel uncomfortable about it, that would kind of help. Anyway, so we got a website, I guess, is traumas.com, TRAMAS.com.
That is correct.
And, yes, for people out there who live in New York, or I guess if somebody was calling you guys or getting in touch with you from another state, you would probably have a connection, right? Or say, here's a place that we would recommend out of another state. I'm sure you may not know one in maybe Colorado, but let's say New Jersey.
If they're interested, they could go to the website. It's called msf-usa.com.
Oh, okay.
And what that will do is it'll bring up their website, and you enter to the state that you're in, and they'll ask you your zip code, and you'll enter that in, and pretty soon, voila, you'll have a list of sites that would be available in your area if you are interested in taking a course. And the curriculum is, whether it's taught in New York State, Colorado, California, we all use the same curriculum. And it's just you're going to have a different rider coach, that's all.
Okay, cool. By the way, did we introduce you? Did we give your name? I don't think so, did we?
I don't know. I don't think we introduced that. My name's William.
Okay. You got a last name?
Yeah, Chin, Chin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
All right, great. Thank you so much, William. You may be teaching me, just at least on the simulator, anyway.
I'd be looking forward to have you come out and take one of the courses. I'm a pretty patient kind of guy. I like people. I like helping people achieve their goals. And if people really want to learn how to ride a motorcycle, and that's the motivation, I'm going to try my best to try and help them do that. Some people,
okay.
I have to warn you, Emeril, some people are not suited for riding, unfortunately.
And I may not, and you'll tell me.
and unfortunately, yeah.
Really, I mean, yeah. You know.
One of the drawbacks to our business is sometimes I have to counsel people out because they're not ready to take the next step forward. But that doesn't mean they don't know how to ride or can't ride. That just means at that time, the skills that they need to progress further are not quite yet there.
Right.
And if they're close enough, I would recommend maybe a private lesson or two to polish off or knock off a little bit of rust, and then you can come right back into the fray and continue on another day.
Okay.
So it's not as all lost, but I would say that if you're really not sure, a little time on the simulator is fine, maybe a private lesson or two, and then come join us out on the range and we'll have some fun.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to actually just Merle goes on the simulator.
Okay. You'll have fun with that.
I don't know that I'll get farther than that, you know,
yeah,
but
give it a try.
But we'll see. I just
okay.
think it would be an interest. I do a lot of I can do it, you can do it thing.
Yes. Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. So well, I so appreciate your calling into us, and hope to get you some business, too.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great evening.
You too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, traumas might be a trauma. I will try doing that. Okay. I'm waiting for Vikas to call in, but I have what I'm going to do is, I'm going to play. Josh Groban has a new CD, so let's play a little of this song, one of the songs called Love Only Knows, and if Vikas calls in, I'll just kind of end it. Here it is.
So long, and we're always such a good thing when it's gone. Would it be alright if we just left our heads tonight? Take me away from this old game. Would it be alright if I just stayed with you tonight? And before I go, will I ever see you again? She said, love only knows. Love only knows if we'll give in to fear and choose life undercover. She said, love only knows if it's special enough, then we'll choose one another. We'll choose each other. Would it be alright if we just lose ourselves tonight? And if you let go, will you reach out again? She said, love only knows. Love only knows if we'll give in to fear and choose life undercover. Love only knows if it's special enough, then we'll choose one another. We'll choose each other. And I can't breathe without you, and I don't. And I can't without love, and I won't, and I won't. Love only knows if we'll give in to fear and choose life undercover.
I'm going to do, I'm going to call, now that I have this thing, this dial out thing, I'm going to try this out, let's see, and I'm going to call there. I'm sure poor Vikas is probably so busy that, okay, let's do this. I love, this is actually fun.
Namaskar, and thank you for calling Junoon. We are located at 27 West, 24...
Please hold a moment.
Instead of hearing the whole thing. Push zero.
Thank you for calling Junoon. This is Desiree. How may I help you?
Yes, may I speak with Vikas, please?
Sure. Who may I ask is calling?
Merle Exit.
Okay, can you hold, please?
Sure.
This is the kitchen office. How can I help you?
Yes, Vikas, please.
Hi, so calling, please?
Merle Exit.
Merle Exit? Okay, hold on one moment, please.
Sure.
Hello?
Vikas?
How are you? I have your phone number right in front of me, and you called me before that. Sorry, I didn't realize 3:30. How are you?
Okay. You forgot to call?
I know it had. I'm holding it till 3:25, and then I started doing something. I forgot. Sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's okay. I'll wind up having you on the air another time as well. But we're on the air now.
Okay. Perfect.
What I want to do before anything is I want to talk about that your restaurant has a tasting menu. You do tastings.
Yes.
And the thing I first want you to describe is what, in terms of being an Indian restaurant, like, is any particular area or all the areas, what is it comprised of?
Okay. You know, while designing the menu, we came up with the idea that we don't want to do something like regional. We didn't want to divide the country. So we came up with techniques, like how the five most powerful techniques of our cooking, we can put them together. And this actually, we just united the whole nation in so many ways with that. Our menus are based on these five major techniques, which are part of modern India plus ancient India. We have a cooking on the stone, which is so ancient and it works still very well. We have a very thick iron griddle cooking. We cook and sear everything on a very thick iron griddle, which is a very high temperature. We have our open pit fire. We have a tandoor. And then we have our pot cooking, which is the most of the curries. So that has helped us to design menus which are so different, because now we are based on the techniques rather than being on the regions.
Well, let me ask you, is this the... now, you work at other restaurants. You have...
Yes.
Pranima, and there was another one, isn't there?
Salaam Bombay.
Okay.
And then
is this
we have
the
a
first...
cafe at the Ribbon Museum.
Oh, right, right, yeah. How do you find the time to do it all?
I am at Junoon right you know, it took us so many years to get this Janoon up and running. It took us more than 4 years. More than 4 years when I met Rajesh, we wanted to do this restaurant. Just the construction itself took more than a year, more than 2 years.
Wow.
But it was a very important part of what we had to be led to. You know, this Janoon is symbolizing for us the journey of all the different paths we took to be led to this restaurant. And I think that's something very powerful, because you have to do all these things to be a part of this. I'm the advising consultant of the Rubin Museum now, and in which I do an annual menu for them. I do a menu on annual basis based on the seasons, and I just give it away to them. But here the whole idea is so much based on the seasons, because the techniques remain the same. But the season.
I guess, Vikas, what I just also want to ask, is this the first time you've had the opportunity to work in a kitchen that gives you has all five techniques?
Indian kitchens generally have two types of techniques. One is the cooking in the tandoor oven, which is the clay oven. The other one is the pot cooking. So generally it was restricted to areas. But as you travel in India, you understand that all these ancient techniques are still very important, and they still exist on specialized. And specialized stores and all these things, people still follow them.
Right.
So,
is this the first place where you've had all of them in one kitchen?
First place. This is actually,
wow.
This was the brainchild of Rajesh. When he started discussing these techniques, and we said, oh, it's totally true. We are forgetting these ancient ways of cooking while we are so focused on being too modern. So he's saying we should be the balance. We'll pick up seasonal elements of the ingredients, and we'll use these ancient techniques to cook this food. You think, because they still work.
Right. So, in other words, you know already, for instance, with the stones, that it's used for a particular meat or particular, what is it like, how do you decide when you're using the stone?
Stone is milder heat, which is more, it's a milder heat as compared to the searing on the griddle. Griddle is extreme heat. What we do is sometimes, you know, there are juices which has to be seared. Like sometimes we do, we also have this menus, which is new menus coming out. We have the shrimp on the cast iron thing. It's so hard that actually it helps you to seal all the juices inside. It sears. That's the technique it's called. And we do it on this. And I think it's also very interesting that the customers can actually see, many people come on the kitchen counter and they see how it's actually been prepared, which is important. The stone cooking is more earthy. It's very earthy cooking. So I try to do anything which is very earthy on the stone.
So I want to also comment that it's an open kitchen, that you could watch everybody do all the cooking.
Absolutely.
If you want.
It's an open kitchen. It's a challenge, but we are delighted that we can showcase our culture, our cuisine, our country like this. We just are so proud and humbled by it. At how people have responded to this is so overwhelming for us.
Well, I want to kind of, because I'm going to do an entirely different show regarding the spices, so I don't even want to get into that yet. But what I would like to talk about is, like, in terms of the tasting. Well, we did a tasting, and do you remember what we had or not?
Yeah, most of the things.
Okay. So what I want you to do is tell everybody, like, what we ate and give me, a description of each of them, kind of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We started with something called, which we so called the Pehla Swad, which means the first taste, which changes every day in the restaurant. But for you, we had the small savory bites, which are made out of lentils. That is how we started. And they were appetizing, and it had the base of tamarind, which is tamarind actually is used for appetite. So we want you to have good appetite, so we give you taste of something which enhances your appetite. After that, we started the course of a soup. It was a lentil soup, three different lentils, and this is the most comfort part of my cooking, because I started cooking, my first stage was learning how to make lentils from my grandmother. So it's a salute to my grandmother who taught me how to cook, started with that. So it's a reminder for me. It's a very important part of me that we say that I still cook exactly the same way. I did not have to change this to be accepted. My cooking had to be accepted in America. It remains as authentic as she would cook. So that's the
second. What were the lentils used?
I use the pink lentils, the yellow lentils, the small ones, and then we also use the chana dal. That's the split chickpea lentils.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
So
I thought
we actually puree them. We puree them.
I thought that Michael said mung beans.
Yes. That is what a lot of people refer to as the yellow lentils.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it.
So
okay.
What we do is that I do them. It's very, very slowly cooked, Merle. You know, this technique is what we learned because I grew up in a very humble house. So we had an open pit fire where the food was cooked. So in the end of the evening, what my grandmother would do before, because the pit still had coal in it or wood in it, so she'll have this pot of lentils and rice, with lentils and water and a little bit of turmeric. She'll keep it on this slow fire, you know, in the end of the herb when she wrapped up the kitchen. It was so interesting that actually those lentils absorbed all the flavors, earthy flavors from this little bit of simmering charcoal which was lying under. So that was a beautiful thing. So I always start. So she prepares the lentils for the next day on this kind of, you know, energy-friendly act what she had in the kitchen.
And then, okay, next?
Next we served you appetizers. We had the cauliflower, which is called the Tree of Life, which is inspired by the whole idea of this restaurant. Do you want to create something which reflects, because we have this whole sculptures of Tree of Life, the theme of Tree of Life comes from Buddha. It's Buddhism, it's Hinduism, in which we say that everything on the planet is connected. A tree reflects that every connection from the sky to the earth. You know, that was something which remained in my mind, and I wanted to do something which looked like that. So this is the only vegetable we cut straight, and it looks like a tree. You know, so we have this cauliflower, which we do this, and then we fry it, and that's the Tree of Life.
So you're frying it in, and are you coating it?
We're coating it with a crust of rice flour. I wanted to keep this dish totally gluten-free.
Oh, that's interesting. And I understand that it's also served with...
garlic tomato chutney.
No, the seeds, the
pomegranate seeds.
Pomegranate seeds, and
that's
purpose
the reflection
was
of the sun, an abstract form of sun rays.
Okay.
I just had to create some fun, you know, because as you start working, you know, you get too serious, and I just think that creating such a thing would, and I tell people that it brings a smile on everybody's face, and they learn to make this for the first time in the kitchen.
Okay. Then next was
your fish course, in which I did fish moili. It was a small pieces of halibut. What I do is these fish is it's soaked in this oil which I make out of turmeric and garlic. That's all. So and olive oil. I coat the fish with that and I sear it, and then I slowly cook it. I sear it on the tawa, and then I let it cook in the oven. Okay. We pour a sauce over it with the coconut-based sauce and mustard seeds. So that was one of the courses which we think is interesting.
Captain,
because
I have shrimps. We need shrimps. Both.
Yeah, I have.
Huh?
Shrimp
we
again.
Have two.
They're coming in or they're here?
Yeah, we have two big boxes of...
Hanji Mal, sorry.
Yes, okay.
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 What's personal? That's the first number, if you can't wait for a second.
I will do that right away. Sorry, thank you. Okay, I'm coming up. Okay. Sorry, Merle.
It's okay.
It's our reservation is out of the roof. Did you see the write-up in Metro?
No.
It's a write-up Metro did half a page. So the reservation is out of the roof right now.
Oh, so you think I better leave it before I start writing?
No. Because they're going to be like, they're like, you know, right now you need to order so much more stuff, and they always have deadlines to order stuff. So I'm trying to order, get more deliveries in by night, whatever I can do with the seafood and everything. Because everything in the restaurant comes fresh every single day. We start cooking in the evening, early in the morning from scratch.
Wow.
And we serve this fish, which is inspired by South Indian cooking. This whole fish dish is inspired by Southern Indian.
Okay, can we get into more of the food yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You remember anything else?
Well, I know there was the kebab.
Yes, Kokori Kebab.
That?
Yeah.
Kokori Kebab. It's made on the open pit fire.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ground lamb, which has been ground 3 times. We actually incorporate air into it to make it extremely tender.
Oh, okay.
So we grind it to a certain point in the machine. And 2-3 times we grind it. And it's always, we try to grind it right before the service. So it still has the kind of, you know, air in it. So when you cook it, it doesn't get stiff. It's very soft, very tender.
It has
It has ginger base, just idea. Ginger, a little bit of star anise. And that's the only marination in it.
Then there was a chicken
kebab, the regular chicken kebab, the chicken tikka.
Yes, that's it, chicken tikka.
It has a crust of pomegranate molasses.
Wow.
And I didn't want to use any artificial colors, so I just had to move in a direction which I have these concentrates which we make, which had all the natural juices and colors.
What is the sauce consist of?
That's mint sauce. That's regular mint chutney.
Oh, no, this was yellow.
Oh, you're talking about the main course. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
that's chicken avdi. That's chicken cooked in saffron and cashew sauce.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that was so good.
That's a very, very creamy, like, you know, it's a little heavy, but, you know, we actually reduced, we now be using half and half, not heavy cream. I try to do that so people don't get filled up too much. You know, sometimes Indian food could be heavy.
Now, there was also three chutneys there.
Yes. It changes every single day. You had cumin and mango.
Mm-hmm.
You had pear and ginger.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had kokum chutney. Kokum is it's a dried fruit which comes from South India. It's black in color and it's extremely sour.
Okay. I was very impressed because I usually like, oh, here we go. Here comes the things that I don't like. They're going to be too spicy and I'm not going to want to eat. And they were all very tasty. And then there was one of the breads that had
prunes and walnut.
Yeah,
that's my favorite.
That was kind of interesting.
People think it's a new bread, but actually it was not new. My grandmother used to make this kind of bread on festivals, but she would make it on a griddle. She would make this kind of bread in whole wheat on festivals, and she'll cut them and give it as people came. And I kept in my mind that, you know, I can change this whole thing in restaurants too, where we can have these kind of nuts used or dried fruits used to make these breads.
Uh-huh.
And I think dry fruits have their own natural sugar.
Right.
So that is a good thing for us.
Then as far as, like, desserts, I mean, they weren't the most common desserts I've ever ate.
We have worked very hard with our pastry chef, I've known her for many years, and she wanted to do something which is totally off the ground. She's a French trained, but she wanted to do something which is totally off what we always do. And I think one thing, what good idea which came when she was telling us was that she said that we have to use familiar flavors. I agree on that. She said, but we cannot just be totally based on the traditional desserts, because sometimes they can be very overwhelming for Americans, the traditional Indian desserts. So she, when we discussing this, we said we need to add texture to this. We need to add certain flavor, certain depth, certain lightness to it. So that is working on it for so many years, and this is where we got so far.
Well, I want to make sure that we give the website. It's Junoon, JUNOONNYC.
Yes.
.com. So you can find out all about the restaurant and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I got about a minute to go. So, I never really introduced it. Zika, it's Kana, right?
Kana.
Okay. So Vikas, I'm going to get back to you because I want to set up to do more and to do another show, as I said, because I want to do this whole thing regarding the spices.
Yes.
Okay. So, gee, I. Okay. I probably should have called you to remind you then. That's okay. But we'll talk again. We'll be on the air again. Okay, take
care.
Thank
you. We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I love you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yes, it actually was the best Indian restaurant I've ever eaten at, and I'm not one for eating at Indian restaurants. Well, I'm ending the show. I'm not sure what I'm doing next week or whatever. But for everybody, have a good day, have a good evening, or whatever you're having.